Welcome to VOA Asia Weekend. Over the next 60 minutes, you'll hear some of the top stories and features of the past week from our daily VOA Asia program. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Here's Ira Melman.
Children return to school in the central Chinese city of Wuhan, the original epicenter of the coronavirus epidemic. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma has more.
According to state media, 1.4 million children have returned to nearly 3,000 kindergartens, primary and secondary schools as part of a nationwide return to classes. Life has largely returned to normal in Wuhan, where the novel coronavirus was first detected late last year. After what critics called an attempt to ignore the outbreak, the city underwent a 76-day lockdown. Wuhan marked a milestone on Sunday when its last confirmed case, a patient who brought the virus from overseas, was released from a city hospital. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
College towns across America are eager to see students return to classes this month and help local businesses recover from the coronavirus pandemic. But as Mariama Diallo reports, local business owners are also worried there will be a surge in new cases.
When the pandemic sent many of Michigan University's 40,000-plus students back home earlier this year, the college town's small business district felt it big time.
It was like a 3-foot blizzard without snow. So, you know, nobody walking on the sidewalks, nobody going up and down the streets.
The fall term begins with at least some in-person classes on campus. That's bringing both hope and anxiety to businesses which rely on the students to stay afloat. Adam Lowenstein is a bar owner.
I'm glad to see the students coming back. Like the first probably emotion is relief, you know, happiness.
Justin Herrick owns a restaurant.
My gut feel is people are going to come back. There's going to be a significant outbreak, and it's either going to be managed and contained, or you know they're going to hit the pause button and go all online. And I think my gut feel is probably the latter.
Jeff Saunders, the owner of a piercing parlor, says he's fought hard to keep his business going.
So the pandemic's really thrown a lot at us. You have to really run your business extraordinarily well to succeed.
Not all places are back up and running. Espresso Royale Coffee, the once successful shop, is not coming back due to the pandemic, according to its website. Former customers like this Michigan U student are disappointed.
Yeah, it kind of sucks that those places are not opening up, especially Espresso Royale. There's a lot of people in my house that like that.
Perry Perico sits in the street outside one of his businesses in a makeshift patio area that didn't exist before the COVID-19 pandemic. Despite troubles, he remains optimistic.
I'm hoping and praying, and I believe that we're going to be okay. We're going to be okay.
Small business owners eager to see students and normalcy again. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook. VOA Asia is also on Twitter and YouTube. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, read, and share all the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news, information, and great features. You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend.
Japan's top government spokesman, Yoshihide Suga, has won the backing of the ruling party's largest faction to become the country's next leader. Reuters' Gloria Tso reports.
Japan's top government spokesman, Yoshihide Suga, is now a strong frontrunner to become the country's next leader after Prime Minister Shinzo Abe announced last Friday that he would resign due to health issues. It was first reported on Tuesday that Suga has now won the backing of the ruling party's largest faction. Suga is Japan's chief cabinet secretary and Abe's longtime lieutenant, and he is widely expected to continue the policy course set out by Abe, including the Abenomics strategy aimed at reviving the economy and keeping it afloat during the global health crisis. Suga has not yet publicly announced his candidacy for leader of the Liberal Democratic Party, but a source tells Reuters he has indicated privately that he intends to run, and media reports said he would formally announce his intention to run on Wednesday. Party Secretary General Toshihiro Nakai said LDP executives agreed to a simplified vote by party MPs from both chambers of parliament and heads of local chapters. That's despite younger LDP legislators presenting a demand for a wider full-scale vote on Monday. The party is expected to hold its leadership vote on September 14th. The party's leader will almost certainly become prime minister because of its majority in the lower house of parliament.
Reuters, Gloria Tso.
A message from your friends at VOA Asia. Can the coronavirus survive in cold weather? Can the virus be spread by mosquito bites? Is there a vaccine or medication that prevents it? Is there any medicine that cures it? The answer to all of the questions is no. The best steps to take: wash your hands, cover your cough, stay at home if you're sick or advised to by local authorities. A message from your friends at VOA Asia.
You're listening to VOA Asia. For the residents along Indonesia's Sisidane River, the coronavirus has brought not just deadly disease, but also a deluge of medical waste, a constant stream of syringes, face masks, and hazmat suits floating by. Libby Hogan reports.
Dirty syringes, used masks, and gloves are among the waste streaming into the Sisidane River in Indonesia's city of Tangerang. Medical waste has been piling high since the first cases of coronavirus in the country. Then, in May, the walls of a landfill beside the river collapsed, sending tons of garbage cascading into the river, doubling the threat for those downstream, families who bathe and wash their clothes in the river. It's triggering fears that the coronavirus could spread as the country still struggles to contain it. 39-year-old Ashri Dewayani is trying to keep her children away from the water.
I worry about the kids getting infected with COVID-19 when they swim here. I'm anxious. That's why I always forbid my children from swimming in the river.
Indonesia has the highest COVID-19 death toll in Southeast Asia. And like many countries, it's also got a huge increase in medical waste. The Ministry of Health has admitted the country lacked treatment facilities and said it was trying to find a solution. Aid Yunus, founder of Sisidane River Rubbish Bank, is working with volunteers to organize a cleanup.
We are concerned about the sustainability of this river. We don't want it polluted with any waste, including industrial waste, which is dangerous, especially during this pandemic.
The health ministry said that up to 1,500 tons of COVID-19 medical waste was produced across the country each day from March until June.
That was Reuters' Libby Hogan reporting. This is VOA Asia. Australian officials say they have spoken with a high-profile Australian television news anchor who has been detained in China. Cheng Li, an Australian citizen, has worked for the Chinese government's English news service, CGTN. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports Cheng's detention in Beijing is seen as another blow to already fragile Australia-China relations.
Cheng Li is being held under what's known in China as residential surveillance at a designated location. The TV presenter hasn't been charged, but she can be detained for up to 6 months without access to a lawyer. Cheng has worked as an on-air anchor and reporter for the China Global Television Network, or CGTN, for the past 8 years. Videos featuring the high-profile journalist have been removed from the channel's online platforms and social media pages. Australia was officially notified of her arrest in the middle of August. A statement from Foreign Minister Maurice Payne in Canberra said diplomats were allowed to speak to her last week via video link. Trade Minister Simon Birmingham says the government will do what it can to help her.
I feel for her family very much at this point in time, and it's why we will do what we can to assist her as we would and have any Australian in these sorts of circumstances. There is a long history of different consular cases and points of difficulty that we've seen over the years, so we shouldn't see this as a first or a one-off. It's concerning for her family, and we will provide the assistance that we can.
It is highly unusual for foreign journalists to be detained in China. Friends of Cheng Li have told Australian media that she was a very skillful operator who knew where the limits on public comment were in China's highly monitored media. It's unclear what she might have done to upset Chinese authorities or break any laws. Cheng was born in China and is an Australian citizen. She is the second Australian to be detained in Beijing. Writer Yang Hengjun is being investigated over alleged espionage and has been held since early 2019. In July, Canberra updated its information for Australians travelling to China, warning they could be at risk of arbitrary detention. Diplomatic tensions between Canberra and Beijing have also been inflamed by disputes over trade, as well as allegations of Chinese interference in Australia's domestic politics and cyber espionage. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Thousands of public pools throughout the United States are still closed due to the COVID-19 pandemic. That is one reason why business is booming for the creators of an app that allows people to rent out their private pools for a few hours. The app is called Swimply, and its founder says business has soared 2,500% since June. Moxie Moskalkov has the story.
Missy Jenkins is carefully cleaning the yard with disinfectants, taking fallen leaves out of the water and readjusting lounge chair pillows. The resident in Alexandria, Virginia, is one of over 7,000 Americans who are renting out their private pool during the summer months.
I signed up Friday, almost 2 weeks ago. I got approved by midday, and it booked up the next day almost entirely. And then every day after that, it continued to book. And then when the reviews started coming in, and all of them so far have been 5-star reviews, very nice reviews, then it started to book up pretty solidly.
Jenkins has been booking renters through an app called Swimply, a platform similar to Airbnb. Jenkins currently works in healthcare. Renting out her pool helps her earn some extra money, enough, she says, to pay the mortgage and cover the pool maintenance.
But it's been fun, frankly. I've met a couple of really cool folks.
Swimply was founded in 2018 by two New Yorkers, Bunim Laskin and Asher Weinberger.
We went into Google Earth. We looked for big blue splotches from the sky. We knocked on 80 doors, and we got kicked out of 76 of them, but we got four homes to sign up. We built a website for $500, put these four pools on the platform, and within weeks, we had thousands of strangers swimming in strangers' pools.
But businesses on Swimply really soared after the COVID-19 pandemic and closure of many public pools, up by over 2,500%, says Weinberger.
On the host side of things, we have hosts who are reaching out to us every day saying, hey, I lost my job, right? And you know, you guys are helping me pay for not just my pool, but my entire mortgage, right? That's very rewarding. And then on the swimmer side, people are trapped at home. They're working from home, no school, no camp. Public venues are closed. Where are you making your 6-year-old's birthday party, right?
The price varies from $15 to $300 an hour, depending on the size, type, and location of the pool. Maxim Moskalkov for VOA News, Washington.
You are listening to VOA Asia. With the coronavirus outbreak, people worldwide have become preoccupied with a threat so physically small that it can't be seen. The invisible world of viruses has long fascinated multimedia artist Laura Splann, who is artist in residence at a biotech lab researching COVID-19. Matt Dibble takes a closer look.
From a distance, they appear to be doilies, the lacy handiwork used to protect furniture in past centuries.
When you look closer, you realize there's something just a little bit off. The doilies reveal themselves to be camouflage for the more deadly viruses lurking in the pattern of each form.
Since the coronavirus outbreak, most of us have been forced to consider a realm beyond our senses, the realm of microbes. It's a world that artist Laura Splann has visited frequently in her work.
There is extreme beauty in the form of these viruses, but there's also a lot of fear that we're certainly experiencing right now with COVID-19.
Splann studied biology, before becoming an artist working at the intersection of science, technology, and culture. A series on proper hand-washing techniques, exhibited at the CDC Museum in 2011, explored our complicated connection with microbes.
They're floating all around us, but they're also part of us. I was interested in letting the viewer consider a different relationship to these microbes.
As artist in residence at Integral Molecular, Splann explores the workings of a biotech lab researching COVID-19 antibodies, including the software used to model viruses.
I'm really interested in seeing how I can leverage this software to do something that hasn't been done with it before.
She shares her work with researchers.
They actually kind of see these images that they take for granted every day in a new way.
And for the rest of us, Splann hopes her animations can provide a brief respite from the pandemic that has consumed the world's attention. For VOA News, Matt Dibble, San Francisco.
VOA Asia Weekend continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. India registered nearly 79,000 new coronavirus cases on Sunday. That was the biggest single-day spike in the world since the pandemic began. The surge raised India's tally to over 3.5 million and came as the government announced the reopening of the subway in its capital, New Delhi. India, with the world's second-largest population behind China, is also moving ahead with limited sports and religious events. The divide between India's urban and rural healthcare is stark. Big cities boast of highly qualified doctors, while most rural areas lack adequate health infrastructure. To bridge the gulf with the help of modern technology, the northern state of Himachal Pradesh has launched a telemedicine program in two remote areas. Anjana Pasricha reports on how residents in one of them are benefiting.
In the remote Himalayan hamlet of Bhrmaur in Himachal Pradesh, there was no orthopedic to examine Ajay Singh's persistent backache. So the local medical center arranged an online consultation with a specialist in the southern city of Chennai. He prescribed a line of treatment that local staff monitors. Like him, scores access highly qualified doctors hundreds of kilometers away through a telemedicine program launched last November. The constant irritation in Sanjay Sharma's throat is improving since he started medication prescribed after a virtual consultation with a specialist.
We have this facility close to our house. I would have had to have traveled at least 10 to 15 hours to a city to consult a doctor. I have saved both time and money.
Although most of rural India struggles with inadequate health facilities, availing healthcare in these Himalayan villages has been specially challenging. The tiny population and bad weather make it hard to attract medical staff. The nearest big city is 400 kilometers away.
Most of the time of the year, these are cut off from the rest of the world because of the heavy snowfall and blockage of the passes connecting these locations to the rest of the district and the state. So people had no option but to get whatever treatment is available there, because either you have to airlift people, which at times gets very difficult.
Now local staff in two places, Bhrmaur and Pongi, has been trained to conduct tests such as ultrasounds and electrocardiograms. Specialists in city hospitals access the reports online. Satellite technology helps overcome the poor connectivity in these areas.
We have been able to cater to about 3,000 consultations in OPD consultations, and more than 60 tele-emergencies have been stabilized at these two locations in last since the inception of the program.
For this resident, a cardiologist's diagnosis of his brother's heart condition was timely. He needed quick attention.
The doctors told us he has a heart problem, a blockage.
We went to Shimla City, where doctors put in a stent. That solved the problem.
The telemedicine program is also helping women whose health problems in rural areas often get neglected.
Doctors here told me to consult a specialist for my persisting headaches. It was diagnosed as migraines. The medicines I have been taking for the past month are helping.
Fears that these difficult roads will cut them off from medical care have been eased for residents in this Himalayan hamlet. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
This is VOA Asia Weekend. Demonstrations against racial injustice continued this past week after the police shooting of a black man in Kenosha, Wisconsin. President Donald Trump is to visit Kenosha later Tuesday, as we hear more from VOA's Arash Arabasadi.
Demonstrators again took to the streets in Kenosha, Wisconsin, days after the police shooting of Jacob Blake. Blake was shot in the back 7 times. He survived, but his family says he is paralyzed from the waist down. Days after the shooting, a white teenager armed with a rifle opened fire on a group of demonstrators, hitting 3 and killing 2. Cell phone video showed him later still carrying his rifle and casually strolling by police. The incident has renewed calls for police reform. Racial injustice protests also continued in the city of Portland, Oregon, where one person was killed amid violent clashes between Black Lives Matter protesters and Trump supporters. Sunday morning, President Trump tweeted law and order, and his acting Secretary of Homeland Security, Chad Wolf, called for restraint.
If you're going to protest First Amendment right, please do that peacefully. Once you cross the line to violence, that is what's concerning to the Department of Homeland Security. That's what I'm focused on, making sure that we bring any type of violence in any of our cities to a close.
Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar rejected attempts by President Trump to paint his Democratic rival, former Vice President Joe Biden, as endorsing lawlessness, saying nationwide protests are raging under the current administration.
This isn't just happening in one place. It's happening all over the country. It is happening under Donald Trump's watch. We have a president that literally stands on the people's lawn and says, oh, do you want to be more safe? We are not safe in Donald Trump's America.
As protests continue, President Trump is due to visit Kenosha on Tuesday to meet local police and survey damage from recent demonstrations following the shooting of Blake. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. Now that the Republicans and Democrats have held their conventions to nominate their candidates for President of the United States, they were scaled-back versions of what President Trump wanted and what the Democrats wanted, as both produced different versions of virtual conventions. VOA's Steve Reddish examines how the two conventions were held, perhaps a glimpse into how future conventions and political rallies around the world might be held.
Republicans started their convention with a sharp contrast to Democrats, conducting the roll call vote of states to renominate President Trump during the day, away from primetime viewers, and with a fraction of the 2,500 delegates attending. Democrats used their roll call vote as a virtual cross-country journey, with delegations showing off a bit of their state while casting votes by video. Matthew Continetti is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute.
I actually think the virtual convention has been a boon to both parties. For one thing, the virtual convention allowed the DNC to really skirt the real intra-party differences among Democrats. You didn't have any huge protests or loud calls of support for Bernie Sanders, say, when his nomination was put into play. And you also didn't have those chants of lock her up, which were interspersed with among all the speeches at the RNC 4 years ago.
While Democrats made generous use of low-tech videos to deliver short speeches, Republicans tried to replicate the staging of a live convention using a mix of recorded and live speeches from a grand auditorium. Only a handful of sitting elected Republican officials spoke. Former President George W. Bush did not. Vanessa Beasley is a communications professor at Vanderbilt University.
The absence of the old guard of the Republican Party is definitely meaningful this year. As we've noted, you want to show the continuity of the party itself. You want to show the parties behind you. And the absence of key figures signals this year that that's not necessarily the case.
Instead, many of the featured speakers for Republicans have been members of the president's family and their significant others. Again, Matthew Continetti.
If the goal of the convention is to enthuse his voter base, maybe remind them of why they voted for Donald Trump 4 years ago, a family member is just as likely to do that as a Republican elected official, and perhaps even more likely, since one thing we know about the Trump base is that they are extremely suspicious of politics as usual.
First Lady Melania Trump expressed sympathies for those who have been affected by COVID-19. Other convention speakers praised the president for his handling of the crisis. While Democrats spent much of their convention criticizing Trump for not doing enough about the pandemic, the politics of it played out in some more subtle ways.
Joe Biden, of course, talked to his guests via Zoom remotely. And whenever Biden was in proximity with other people, he always was sure to model the use of a mask. Donald Trump, on the other hand, conducted his panels in person in the White House, and there were no masks involved. I think that speaks to larger differences between the two parties, not only on how to approach the coronavirus, but also the future of America in general.
And both parties claim the other is painting a dark picture of the American future if the opposing candidate wins. Again, Vanessa Beasley.
I think what's interesting about this moment is that that optimism as a claim is being manifest quite differently. In the Democratic National Convention, it was almost a more somber and intimate tone, some sense of even some mourning, especially when they showed pictures of people whose lives have been lost to COVID-19. And the optimism in the Republican case was manifest in terms of a higher volume, a tone of what will happen if the future is left in the hands of the Democrats.
Without a live audience to react and applaud, speeches have been shorter at both conventions, but fewer people watched either convention on television than did 4 years ago. Steve Reddish, VOA News, Washington.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to find them easily. With VOA Asia, you can also follow radio program host VOA Stevenson and VOA Melman. VOA Asia Twitter. We're always online for you.
With many of the top stories from the past week, we continue now with VOA Asia Weekend. During a novel coronavirus pandemic that has taken the lives of more than 170,000 Americans, five former directors of the U.S. Centers for Disease and Control have been asking, where is the CDC? The former directors say the CDC's response to the pandemic has fallen short and that its traditional lead role has been sidelined. VOA's Carol Pearson reports.
This is where CDC experts track every major outbreak in the world. They have helped stem the spread of Ebola, tracked the progression of a pandemic flu, partnered with the World Health Organization to end polio, and much more. Dr. David Satcher, one former director, says countries around the world look to the CDC for health information.
See, what I remember is that whenever there was a major issue in the world, people called the CDC before they called the World Health Organization, even though there was a very good working relationship between the CDC and WHO.
In dealing with the coronavirus pandemic, CDC critics say it has failed, that its first coronavirus test was tainted. Yet five former directors still in health leadership roles defend the agency, saying much was unknown at the beginning. Dr. Julie Gerberding is now a vice president at the pharmaceutical giant Merck.
What I would love to be able to do is to rewind the tape, because we do know some things for sure about this virus. We know it's incredibly transmissible, and we know that most people are still susceptible.
When Dr. Tom Frieden headed the CDC, he made several trips to West Africa during the Ebola crisis to see how the agency could help end the epidemic. He says with any new disease, the unknowns are far greater than what is known.
The more we learn, the more we know, the better we can control it.
Dr. Frieden heads a global health initiative called Resolve to Save Lives. All five doctors say it's time to put politics aside and pull together to end the crisis. Dr. David Satcher says there's no substitute for strong leadership.
Somebody needs to call attention to what we have to do together. And that's a level of leadership that for which there's no substitute. It's at the level of the president.
President Trump has been pushing for schools and businesses to reopen, even though the virus has not been contained. Dr. Richard Besser says it's a mistake to ignore or rewrite CDC guidelines.
If you have politicians saying that CDC guidance is a barrier to getting children back into school instead of the roadmap for doing it safely, the whole system breaks down.
Since the coronavirus broke out in the U.S., the information comes from the White House. The former CDC directors say the information is sometimes wrong, dangerous, or misleading.
Right, and then I see the disinfectant where it knocks it out in a minute, 1 minute. And is there a way we can do something like that by injection inside or almost a cleaning?
The president later said he was being sarcastic. After leaving the CDC, Dr. Jeffrey Copeland established the Global Health Institute at Emory University in Atlanta. He says everyone must work together to end this pandemic.
We need to feed truth back to the American public and to use those truths with our scientific evidence to control this disease.
Dr. Jeffrey Copeland says everyone must work together to end this pandemic.
If we could all just be pulling in the same direction, we would make considerable progress quickly.
A White House spokesman told VOA the administration and the CDC have been working together since the start of the pandemic, and that the president's highest priority is the health and safety of the American public. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
How to stay healthy. Wash your hands with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. Scrub thoroughly for 20 seconds. If you cannot wash your hands, use a hand sanitizer. Taking these steps can prevent not only coronavirus, but also colds and flu and other viruses.
Now on VOA Asia Weekend, the man-made mega constellation orbiting Earth may one day bring internet to remote parts of the world. But astronomers say the cost to research is high. VOA's Arash Arabisadi brings us the week in space.
3, 2, 1, 0. Ignition and liftoff for the Falcon 9. Good Starlink.
For weeks now, VOA has been reporting on the SpaceX mega constellation under construction in Earth's orbit. The commercial spaceflight company continues to successfully launch batches of its Starlink satellites to build a floating broadband internet network. SpaceX says the service will connect online remote and underserved parts of the world. But astronomers say the satellites are an eyesore for observation labs. Joined by engineers and commercial satellite operators at a recent scientific workshop, astronomers released a report saying they simply can't see beyond the brightness and interference of satellite networks like Starlink. Reports indicate the news caught everyone, including SpaceX, by surprise. Meanwhile, astronomer Cees Bassa captured this video he posted to YouTube from near an observatory in the Netherlands. He called the lights a sight to see, but says after some research, it appears that about one in every 100 Starlink satellites in orbit will remain bright and visible most summer nights above Asia, North America, and Europe. SpaceX aims to have 1,600 Starlinks in orbit by year's end and has federal approval to launch nearly 12,000 in total, with eyes on 30,000 more in the future. Arash Arabisadi, VOA News, Washington.
As New York City slowly and carefully returns to a relative normal after weeks of strict lockdown measures to stop the spread of coronavirus, Movie theaters in the Big Apple are hoping to open their doors again. In the meantime, New York City outdoor movies have become popular again during the pandemic. Nina Vishneva has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
Here, there is no need to do temperature checks, wash hands with sanitizer, or use masks. With the Manhattan skyline as a backdrop, any movie is a masterpiece. Back to the Future, especially.
With the world that we live in now and social distancing, this is an easy date while still social distancing. So, dating 2020.
COVID, like you can't go to the movies, you can't go in anywhere else. It's like a chance to sit out here and take in a movie and see like the skyline and just something different.
New York City is being careful about experiencing so many deaths earlier this year as a major coronavirus hotspot. While the movie theaters are ready to reopen, their doors will remain locked for now.
Right now it's closed along with our film center and it hasn't been open since March 12th.
Leslie Kleinberg is the executive director of the Lincoln Center Film Society. She has yet to receive any instructions from city or state authorities regarding reopening the Lincoln Center cinema halls. However, some serious prep work has already been done. The ventilation systems have been refurbished, the movie collection has grown.
Because normally we'd be restricted to the physical theaters, and so now we can actually program, you know, 8 or 9 films at a time.
The city's annual film festival, which starts in late September, won't be constrained in any way. All the movies will be shown in New York's open spaces.
We want the New York Film Festival to be a real festival of New York. Normally, we actually have the festival exists only within the confines of 65th Street. And this year, going out into the city is very significant for us. We think film can be a way for the city to open up, for people to come out and enjoy the arts again.
Chain movie theaters around New York still display posters from March. But in anticipation of reopening someday, they had to do some major adjustments. The movie theaters will have to operate at only 30 to 50% capacity. Ventilation systems have undergone major renovations, and in between screen times, each auditorium will be thoroughly cleaned. When they are finally allowed to reopen, one movie theater chain promises to only charge 15 cents. That's how much AMC, the largest U.S. movie theater chain, charged for a ticket 100 years ago. Small private theaters will have a harder time adjusting to the new reality, but they are working on setting up online screenings. A drive-in theater might be the only option for now in New York City, and until fall with its rainy weather takes over, it might also be the most enjoyable. For Nina Vishnova in New York, Anna Rice, VOA News.
This month marks 3 years since Myanmar's military launched an escalated campaign against the mostly ethnic Muslim Rohingyas in Rakhine State, with systematic rape, beatings, killings, and burning of villages. Now activists are calling on the United States to designate the persecution of the Rohingyas as genocide, saying if the United States leads, other countries will follow. VOA's diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain tells us more.
On August 25, 2017, Myanmar's military launched a brutal campaign, forcing more than 740,000 Rohingyas to flee, mostly to camps in neighboring Bangladesh, joining hundreds of thousands of Rohingya refugees who were already there after fleeing earlier persecution. Now, 3 years later, Myanmar's government has failed to ensure that the nearly 1 million Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh can return home safely. The U.S. and other countries have determined that Myanmar carried out ethnic cleansing. But a Rohingya activist told a forum of the U.S. Commission of International Religious Freedom that the term ethnic cleansing does not carry the same legal weight as genocide.
We need the stronger, drastic actions from the world, from the international communities, from the United States, and to name the crime what it is, and then take there from it to you know, in moving forward. Otherwise, we're stuck. We're in a limbo, and we cannot let the community continue to face and to live in this limbo.
Myanmar government leaders, including Nobel Peace Prize laureate and civilian leader Aung San Suu Kyi, defended the military campaign in front of the International Court of Justice as actions against terrorists. But the court ordered Myanmar to take all measures within its power to prevent the mass killings of Rohingyas. Human rights activists say more needs to be done to pressure Myanmar's leaders to grant basic rights to Rohingyas, including citizenship.
You have a government in Burma today that denies these crimes have taken place. You have a government that cannot even use the term Rohingya. It is 2020.
Activists say the situation for Rohingyas in the camps is deteriorating with heat, crowding, and the threat of the coronavirus, and that the persecution of minorities is still going on in Myanmar today.
Myanmar leaders are still intent on erasing the Rohingya people as the Rohingya as a people. They are destroying us. For the some 600,000 Rohingya today remain in Arakan state, their life continue to resemble in open air prison.
Tun Khin said the United States has always taken a leadership role in calling out ethnic crimes, and that if the U.S. stands up for the Rohingyas now, other countries will follow. Cindy Sain, VOA News, Washington.
VOA Asia Weekend continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Officials in Australia say a large housing development project could be blocked to protect endangered koala bears in one of the fastest-growing parts of Australia's biggest city. The New South Wales government plans to create a sanctuary in Sydney to preserve the country's last remaining disease-free koalas. The animals are listed as vulnerable across New South Wales. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Koalas could be extinct in New South Wales within 30 years. That grim warning came from a parliamentary committee in June. The state government says it's determined to save one of Australia's most recognisable indigenous animals. It's creating a new reserve on Sydney's suburban fringe to allow koalas to use protected woodland corridors to travel between habitats. 100,000 trees will also be planted. The New South Wales Environment Minister is Matt Keane.
We're here to announce the Georges River Koala National Park. We'll be securing 1,885 hectares of koala habitat to ensure that the koala survives in this fortress population forever.
A plan to build hundreds of homes in the area could be vetoed by the state government after scientists found that koalas wouldn't be properly protected. Keane warned the construction company he may not approve the development plans.
I will not be signing off on the biodiversity certificate unless your development meets all the recommendations of the chief scientist.
The developer has said that protecting native wildlife was a key consideration, but has yet to formally respond to the state government. Critics have said the koala sanctuary isn't big enough, but Kate Fearman, a Greens parliamentarian, believes it's a good start.
It is a welcome first step. Thank you very much, New South Wales Government, for recognising that this koala colony out in Campbelltown, it's our only chlamydia-free population. It is so important. There's anywhere between 200 and 600 koalas out there that have to be protected. They've recognised this.
Koalas face many threats, including chlamydia, a bacterium that can cause pneumonia and infertility. Bushfires, habitat loss, attacks by dogs and road accidents are also significant threats. But in other parts of southern Australia, officials have said there are too many koalas and that overabundant populations have damaged valuable types of trees. Also south of Sydney, a group of koalas rescued from last summer's devastating bushfires has been released back into the wild. Three of the animals are named after the crew of a US waterbombing aircraft that crashed in Australia in January. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
We're glad to have you with us. for VOA Asia Weekend. The Republican National Convention portrayed President Donald Trump as a strong commander-in-chief, facing down enemies and demanding more of allies. His opponent, former Vice President Joe Biden, says he will stand with U.S. allies and not dictators. White House correspondent Patsy Whitaker-Suara has this analysis on the vision presented by both candidates on U.S. relations with the world.
In his acceptance speech at the Republican National Convention, President Donald Trump argued that his opponent, Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden, is a weak leader who will destroy the country.
Joe Biden spent his entire career outsourcing their dreams and the dreams of American workers, offshoring their jobs, opening their borders, and sending their sons and daughters to fight in endless foreign wars.
During the Democratic National Convention, Biden, vice president during the Obama administration, portrayed Trump as a dangerous leader who has ruined America's standing in the world.
I'll be a president who will stand with our allies and friends and make it clear to our adversaries the days of cozying up to dictators is over. Under President Biden, America will not turn a blind eye to Russian bounties on the heads of American soldiers.
The Democrats' foreign policy platform opposes forever wars, proposes less spending on national defense, and criticizes China's trade practices. Republicans continue to rally around President Trump's foreign policy goals, which he sums up as America First, a slogan he made famous during the 2016 campaign. Other foreign policy goals: bring American troops home and end reliance on China. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo lauded Trump's America First policies.
It may not have made him popular in every foreign capital, but it's worked.
The Democrats featured Republican Colin Powell, former Secretary of State under the George W. Bush administration, who said Biden will take care of American troops.
It comes from the experience he shares with millions of military families, sending his beloved son off to war and praying to God he would come home safe.
Trump's speech focused mainly on China in the context of the pandemic, trade relations, and outsourced jobs, claiming that Beijing would own the U.S. if Biden got elected.
The Republicans are talking about who is more hardline and who can be tougher on China. The Democrats are speaking about who can be more effective in competing with China. This isn't just about poking the dragon through bellicose speeches, insults, and accusations. This is about leveraging American strengths, increasing our competitiveness, working with allies, and using diplomacy to manage competition effectively in the service of American interests in what is going to be a long-term, high-stakes, high-cost competition with China.
While the two candidates present starkly different views, foreign policy is not a deciding factor in the election.
It's rare for it to be a top one, two, or three considerations among voters, except during times of war. Now, the big concerns have to do with COVID, they have to do with the economy, and concerns about character, a kind of leadership that we're going to observe going forward, either under a Trump administration or a Biden administration.
Still, the candidates are expected to discuss it during the debates in September, including the issue of foreign interference in the November election. Patsy Whitaker-Suara, VOA News.
Now on VOA Asia Weekend, in New York City, locals are changing their daily routines to make them fit into the new reality of life with coronavirus. VOA's Nina Vishneva went to Wall Street and popped by a fashion designer's studio to find out how lifestyles and habits have changed since March. Anna Rice narrates her story.
Yeah. Hello. Hi, Deborah. Wonderful. So what we're going to talk today is about what is changing in the fashion.
Fashion consultations are conducted online as designer and fashionista Martina Dietrich helps her clients put together a post-quarantine capsule wardrobe.
So what we need is actually only something from here up to here, because we're all sitting in front of the laptop and the computer and we have Zoom meetings.
The pandemic has changed lifestyles all over the country. Fashion involuntarily changed as well, putting an end to familiar office wear and making comfort a number one priority. And this age of the Zoom call means shifting attention from a complete outfit to one that fits in a small window on a laptop.
This coat you can also wear other way around, And then, of course, if you have a moment and you go anywhere, then you have a shoulder back, either open back. But in this case, we are sitting in front of the computer and we just have it on Zoom. And then there's another possibility in this code that you can actually to reverse it. I always make the pieces that you have more out of it.
New York City is trying on all kinds of new normal. The consequences of the pandemic show in every sphere of life. Even the things that were ingrained in the everyday routine have to change and adapt.
I have to do the lessons online now, and it's harder because the instructions, I cannot really understand them fully because it's different when you're in class and when you're at home.
Lifestyle, I've been here 35 years, I never see such thing like this. All my savings, you know, I wasted. I don't have no more savings, you know.
I have a big change, changed a whole lot, you know. Things I used to do, I can't do anymore. Places I used to do, I can't go. Can't communicate with family and stuff. It really has a big impact, but I'm just taking one day at a time.
The subway remains half empty as New Yorkers prefer to walk. People headed back to work prefer the relative safety of their cars. Lots of businesses closed. By January, over 600,000 jobs might disappear. Stores that specialize in office attire, one by one, are announcing their bankruptcy. Among them are Brooks Brothers, N. Taylor, Neiman Marcus, Loft, and Lord & Taylor.
I haven't worn a suit since February.
Michael Potter contemplates a new office. His company, called Monarch Capital, has been occupying office space in this building since early 2000s. The pandemic has hit the investment sector quite hard, and businesses can't just continue to operate as before.
You don't need as much support staff. You know, what we're realizing is if you're working from home, you're getting a lot of things done by yourself, you don't need the administrative or operational support staff.
Many hope September will bring back some sort of normalcy. New York City authorities have already announced children can go back to in-person school, which means some parents may be able to go back to work. But some of those offices may never be as full of workers as they were pre-COVID. For Nina Vishnyova in New York, Anna Rice, VOA News.
Coronavirus questions. Can the virus be spread by mosquito bites? Is there a vaccine or medication that prevents it? Is there any medicine that cures it? The answer to all of the questions is no. The best steps to take: wash your hands, cover your cough, stay at home if you are sick or advised to by local authorities.
We continue with VOA Asia Weekend. The U.S. Capitol was again the site of another March on Washington, 57 years after the historic March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, during which Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his iconic I Have a Dream speech. This year's march followed months of demonstrations about police violence against black people. Isha Sarai tells us more.
57 years after the March on Washington, racial justice advocates gathered once again in Washington, D.C., in the wake of protests across the country against police violence involving black Americans.
We never got the full citizenship. We never got the reparations. We come to Lincoln because you promised, Mr. Lincoln, and the promise has been broken. And we come like Dr. King came 57 years ago to say we are tired of broken promises.
Participants from all around the country.
Newcastle, PA.
Polk City, Florida.
I am from Cleveland, Ohio.
I live in Connecticut.
Took buses, trains, and their own cars to attend what they called a historic moment amid the COVID-19 pandemic.
I was raised in the 60s and 70s, where we were forcefully integrated. And so I thought at that time, even though I was too young to participate in like what was going on as far as people standing up for civil rights, I did understand what was happening. And so to see that still today in 2020, we have issues with racism and equality and right to vote, still is just disturbing to me.
Police killings of black Americans have become a potent political issue in this year's presidential election. Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, and others who have died in police custody have led many to demand changes to the country's policing system.
It's about stopping the police brutality that has been going on, right? It's about getting people awareness of voting, right? That's our right. So that's why I'm out here, is what he just said, no justice, there's no peace. And that's what we want, justice and peace.
Public opinion polls show clear majorities of Americans believe black people and other minorities are not treated the same as whites in the criminal justice system. But polls also show about half the country supports the Black Lives Matter movement.
You know, it's going to take Americans of all different ethnic backgrounds to make this work, to make this happen. You know, to give everyone, you know, America's promise.
Black Lives Matter protests are expected to continue in the coming weeks as the presidential campaign enters its final stretch, and activists try to channel their street protest movement into new policies and laws. Isha Sarai, VOA News, Washington.
Two films explore the cycle of violence, trauma, and incarceration in the black community of post-Hurricane Katrina New Orleans. VOA's Penelope Palou spoke with filmmakers and community organizers of the documentary Freedia Got a Gun and of the drama feature Reza's Cutthroat City. They chronicle causes of systematic violence in the Big Easy, which was devastated 15 years ago by a Category 5 hurricane.
The death of Big Freedia's brother, Adam Ross, marks the second fatal shooting in Central City this month.
The shooting that took Ross's life on January 2018 spurred Big Freedia, a popular hip-hop musician in New Orleans, to address the vicious circle of violence, trauma, and incarceration in her community.
Yesterday, I lost a close friend of mine, and the day before that, I lost someone else that I know. So just every day on some kind of level, we're losing people, and it's just so sad and it's so heartbreaking.
She attributes this crisis to gun violence that leaves fatherless and motherless children to fend for themselves, a cycle of violence that continues as youngsters seek revenge for the killings of the parents and friends. At a middle school forum on gun violence, students are jaded by the violence and death around them.
Go outside, they just pop shooting for nothing, like, a bullet could hit anybody. A bullet don't got no name.
I would hold my daddy when he was dying slowly, when he was wounded by a gun bullet.
Trauma and criminal behavior often lead to incarceration.
I got two charges, carjacking and possession of a weapon.
According to the CDC, Louisiana has the fifth highest number of gun-related deaths in the U.S. It also has one of the highest rates of incarceration in the nation, with one out of 100 Louisianians imprisoned. Of those, there are four black prisoners for every white one.
It's the slave mentality. That's the problem. That's the heart of the problem. We are inclined to do the things that we do.
According to the documentary, Hurricane Katrina, which struck New Orleans 15 years ago, exacerbated crime and violence in the city by destroying the local economy and displacing some 400,000 residents.
It changed the dynamics of the city. It changed the neighborhoods. Whole neighborhoods were washed out. And as people came trickling in, you know, they had lost their homes. They'd lost everything.
Post-Katrina destruction, displacement, and crime in New Orleans is also the theme of the feature film drama Reza's Cutthroat City. The film starts on a positive note with Blink, one of the main characters, a graphic novel artist, dreaming for a better life. But then Katrina strikes the Lower Ninth Ward, a low-income district, and upends the life of Blink and his community. Unable to get a job or get help from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, he turns to crime. One heist leads to another, making it harder and harder for Blink to get out of a hopeless situation. Hopelessness during post-Katrina New Orleans is Reza's theme. The film also describes how corruption has been plaguing the city for generations. Reza's Cutthroat City appears to be a place where dreams of poverty-stricken African Americans come to die. Still, the filmmaker says his film ends with the redemptive note that people have the power to turn their lives around.
The lotus flower grows out of mud. Okay, the community could be mud, but a flower could grow out of it. I think everyone deserves a second chance, or at least to have the option.
Katrina's always been with us. It's had a bunch of different names.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
This has been VOA Asia Weekend, a compilation of some of the stories presented throughout the past week on our daily VOA Asia program. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Check out VOA Asia online at voanews.com.